This is an interview with Auntie Jenny Beale on the 31st of March 2014 at Buddha Carbon in Hebersham. So, Auntie Jenny, can you just tell me your full name and when and where you were born and who your mob is, please?
My name is Jennifer Beale and I was born at Gunnedah in 1955. And my mob comes from Gomeroi and Wanarua.
So today we're going to be talking a little bit about your dad and uncle. So I might start firstly with your dad. Can you tell me a little bit about, firstly, can you tell us your dad's name and a little bit about his experiences in the armed forces?
My dad was called Frederick Beale, but he was known as Fred. And he was 30 years of age when he joined up. He was married and had three children, and he joined up with his brother, who was Uncle George, who was 36 at the time. They enlisted at Gunnedah and went into the 2nd 20th. 8th Division, which then went on to go overseas and were at the fall of Singapore and were taken prisoner of wars.
Okay, so they were POWs in Japan, is that correct?
Well, they ended up in Japan as POWs. When they enlisted, they came down to Paddington, and where they were actually then signed up, and they were sent to just over the army camp, just over the back here.
Okay.
I forget the name of it.
Holsworthy?
No, it wasn't. It was part of Holsworthy, but it was just over. And anyway, they ended up going to Bathurst, and they did training there, and then they came back to Sydney, and they ended up. Blink.
That's okay.
What happens when you get old?
But were they both in the same battalion?
They were both in the same battalion, the 2nd 20th. So they were much older than a lot of the other soldiers and things like this that actually went over, because a lot of the 2nd 20th were made up of younger people.
Yeah.
And I think when you look at the times, like back then when people were living on, you know, at Kluwer's and living at Karuna, you know, the missions, that people really didn't have much choice either. Mm. You know, when it came to actually, my dad was a shearer, and they used to, and he worked in, Uncle George, they worked on Heath's property, which was out between Kluwer's and Gunnedah, and the actual two Heath brothers that they actually worked with went over as well. Mm-hmm. They joined.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So do you know what inspired them to join the armed forces?
I think it was basically, it's interesting because I think that when their country is under threat, that they went over to, you know, to fight for the country, which is really interesting because they weren't even citizens in their own country at the time. And I don't know whether it was also that, you know, they had an income coming in as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But, you know, my family came, like my grandfather was a tracker, and so they had really great tracking abilities and things like this. And they were actually used a lot when, you know, my dad would tell me stories about when they used to go out into the jungle, and him and Uncle George would go out and they'd be in the trees and things like this to spot the Japanese and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd come back and tell. So they're still being used as trackers.
Mm-hmm.
And also remember at that time, they at first they wouldn't, you know, they weren't sort of too pleased to let Aboriginal soldiers and things like this join up, and they were actually, you know, sort of casting them down because they were saying, oh, well, you know, they're quarter caste, half caste, whatever, or even measuring in eights, that then they thought, well, they had that much whiteness in them that they, the fear that they would turn against them and go with the Japanese. Yeah. And so they were very hesitant, I think, the army to actually enlist non Aboriginal soldiers.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really, I reckon, is really interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And as they needed more soldiers because they were getting killed over there, they, you know, then they had to sort of say, well, look, okay, we'll let Aboriginal people in. And they actually, the second 20th was very much a country. It was a lot of country boys and that were listed in there. They actually went out to the country areas. So it was like North Coast and country New South Wales that actually came into that 2nd and 20th Battalion.
Mm-hmm. And so how long were they POWs? In Japan?
Well, they were taken at the fall of Singapore, and the fact is they had no ammunition, and that's what happened at the fall of Singapore, that they had no ammunition, and they were virtually sent over there with no bullets, and they had to surrender. So they were first taken to Changi prison camp, and they were in Changi, and then they were transported then by boat to Japan.
Okay, and so they were forced to work as steel mill labourers there.
Yes. They were forced to work as a steel work at the time. And the prison camp that they were in, the Nyatsu prison camp, it wasn't until much later that my father never really talked very much about his experience. Like, you get little snippets, but he was never one to sort of, you know, sit down there and do the bragging of the war stories and things like that.
Yeah.
Anzac Day was very much a day that we spent together as a family.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really march because it brought back memories. It was a very, for him, to bring back the, you know, thinking of his brother and they were very close. They used to be, even though there was, you know, 6 years difference in them, because Uncle George was born in 2004 and Dad was born in 2011, or 7 years, I think it is. But difference in ages, they were called, used to call them the twins because they were very much alike. You know, as I said, you know, they both, and they both had married two sisters at that time. And so they were, you know, very, very close and did everything together.
Yeah. And your Uncle George actually had an accident working in the steel mill. Are you able to tell me a little bit about that and what happened?
Well, what happened with Uncle George was that they had them working 24-hour shifts, and they had them on different shifts as well because of them being brothers. And Uncle George was working on the coal belts, and his foot got caught on the belt, and his leg got damaged, and he virtually started to get ripped from his groin up into his stomach, and nobody knew how to turn the machine off, and eventually the machine got turned off, and he was in excruciating pain and had lost a lot of blood. And because of his femoral artery, and he was taken to their little military hospital, and they tried to fix him up. They tried to fix his leg up, and then they, in the book Hell's Heroes, it talks about him being sewn up with, trying to sew him up with steel wire, and that he had lost consciousness, and the fact that, you know, he hadn't had any anaesthetic, and they were trying to, they had no blood to give him, and they were making for the soldiers to the other prisoner of wars to actually go over and donate blood to try to give him blood. And as they were getting ready, he passed away. And that's really sad.
Mm. That's very tragic.
Mm. Very tragic for my dad. And to actually come through all that, because my Uncle George was killed on the 20th. Well, he died on the 28th of May in 1943. So they'd been together for quite a long time, going through there, being taken prisoner of war. And being in Changi and then going to Japan and then this to happen into it. Tragic for my dad. The Japanese actually showed rare compassion at that time, and which was very rare for them because they were very cruel, and they let the men have a 10-minute service for my uncle, and then he was cremated, and my dad, they gave my dad his ashes, and my dad had his ashes with him until the end of the war, which, you know, was in 1945. Mm. And my dad was always going to bring those ashes home to Australia. Mm. But he never got to do that. He was in the camp. My dad was in the camp for 3.5 years, and when he when the war ended, and he was released. Well, they were released, bringing them home, and he went to board the ship, the Chichilinka, the hospital ship, which was a British hospital ship. They took the ashes off him. The British took the ashes off him and wouldn't let him bring them home on the ship.
Mm.
And Uncle George's ashes, well, his is in Yokohama. Well, I hope his ashes are there.
Mm-hmm.
But his plaque is in the cemetery, war cemetery,
mm-hmm.
in Yokohama, where a lot of POWs ashes are, because a lot of them were cremated in Japan. But it's really interesting, like Dad used to tell me, like little snippets where they were very confused, the Japanese guards, and because they didn't believe that it was black people in Australia.
Wow. Mm.
Okay. And so they used to try to, you know, tell them that they were Indians and things like this, but yeah, they just, yeah, the colour of the skin confused them.
Yeah.
Because they had all white, and then they, you know, had, you know, a couple of black soldiers and there, and it just subtly, yeah, confused them. Naiatsu prison camp was 9 of the guards were actually trialled for their war crimes and actually hanged, I think. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So, did your dad tell you anything about how he was treated in the?
Well, they didn't. They were starved. Yeah. Like, you know, he used to tell me about them eating, you know, rice all the time, and he, you know, that they, you know, things like that, whatever little bits of things, they'd have maggots in the rice and that type of thing, but they actually had to eat it. They had very little food. They didn't have the warm clothing, because imagine, like, my dad had never seen snow.
Mm.
And he ended up in this prison camp with, you know, where they had 2 or 3 foot of snow. Mm. So how cold it was, and how malnourished, you know, they never got fruit or anything like that, or, you know, good food or anything. They were beaten a lot. Not that he actually had told me, but, you know, he had marks on his scars on his back, which I never really... He wouldn't say, you know, what they were from.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started reading Hell's Heroes, the book that was by Roger Maynard, it's been very difficult for me to read this book because of what they had all gone through. And, you know, when you think about it, when they sort of came back, they really got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They were sort of... they didn't get the same recognition as the white men or the white soldiers, their colleagues, who, you know, some of Dad's friends, you know, they actually, and I never knew this until, you know, the funeral anyway, when his funeral, and some of them had come to his funeral, but, you know, they got lived on Collaroy Plateau and over near Manly and all this type of thing because they all got, you know, the war home grants, and, you know, my dad couldn't even get, you know, and it was very difficult for him to even get an Aboriginal, you know, housing commission house. He was refused that. You know, even an Aboriginal housing loan he couldn't get. And I think that's really sad that they never recognised. My dad couldn't read and write very well. So, you know, he could sign his name. He only went to fourth class and then he was out working and helping keep the family because his mum actually died at a very young age. His mum died in childbirth with his baby brother. He was one of 7, him and Uncle George, children. And
so he didn't get any of the same benefits as the...
No.
The non-Aboriginal soldiers.
No, not that any of the same benefits. And even in, you know, they weren't allowed to really be, had much to do with RSL clubs and that type of thing. It's only, it was very different because remember they're coming back to a country that was still, they weren't even counted as citizens until 1967. You know, and he's coming back from war, you know, after 1945. So once they sort of, you know, discharged them from the army, it was, you know, very hard for them. A lot of them, they got dog tags that made them honorary white men, that they could actually go in and they could drink in motels and stuff like that. But a lot of them drank themselves to death because, you know... They went back to the missions, they had to have permission to go back on the missions, and it depends on the white mission manager and what it was of the day. So maybe, you know, they could, you know, freely walk around, but to what extent that their lives were still oppressed and controlled, which the non-Aboriginal soldiers... You know, got quite a lot of benefits, and even to the point of you know being able to. I remember my dad when he TPI pension, which was the total permanent disability pension for soldiers, and I remember very clearly that they thought it was very hard for him to get that pension, and he. Because they had them working in the steel works and that type of thing, he'd actually, his lungs, he had problems with his lungs and where he had, you know, chronic obstructive lung disease, airways disease, and he had to virtually have one foot in the grave before he got his TPI.
Mm.
And I remember he had hemolytic anemia, and they sort of said, well, look, there's not much we can do for him. You know, send him home. And, you know, just my mum just nursed him. And he, you know, survived that. And that's when they gave me his TPI pension. So he did go on to live, and he died. He passed away in 1982. At 81 years of age.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for what he had been through, he still, you know, was able to live for that long. And it wasn't until not long before he died that we were able to get pictures of Uncle George's headstone in the War Cemetery in Yokohama. Mm-hmm. And he actually saw pictures off that, where his brother and the plaque and everything like that. He always, you know, talked about him every day. That I, you know, as long as I can remember anyway, he talked about, you know, Uncle George. It was like we didn't know Uncle George, but we knew Uncle George.
Mm.
So we knew what he was like and his character and everything about him. And he was so close to his heart.
Mm. Your dad kept his memory alive.
Yeah.
And it must have been very devastating for him to lose him in that way.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I just think, you know, how strong he must have been to go through all that and to still be in that prison camp and to still come home and... and to keep, you know, his spirit alive, you know, through memory and with us kids growing up, you know, as I said, that we really know him,
yeah,
even though we didn't grow up, you know, with him or never met him, that we know him.
And so there's quite a well-known picture, that one of your dad and your Uncle George. That was taken in Japan?
No, that one was taken when they enlisted and before they were about to set off on set overseas. And it was taken at Clueless. And they're very much like they're the same height, and the features are, you know, Uncle George's got a bit more finer features. But my dad was a very quiet man, you know, very, very quiet. I've never ever heard him really raise his voice in all my life. Never raised his voice, never raised his hand to us. But you knew when he said something, you really knew it. But he didn't have to raise his voice. He didn't have to. He never hit us or anything like that. But, very never talked about people. And he just went on. And he was well-liked, you know. Because, and very, even though he couldn't read and write, he was very clever. He could do anything. He could, you know, build boats and weld, fix cars, build things. He was just so smart, even though he couldn't read and write. And he ended up working on the Water Conservation Irrigation Commission. And he that run the big powerhouses and all the motors and everything like that. And what happened was, because he couldn't read and write, when he'd go to sit the exams for his engine tickets, he failed. And then the engineer came around and said to my mum, you know, Fred's we know he knows the work, but he's not passing the exam. And Mum said, well, look, I'm not sure whether I should tell you this, but, you know, Fred's reading and writing is not very good.
Mm.
So what they did was they went and got the local policeman to come out, and he sat in the room and he asked the questions. Dad answered them and the engineer wrote them down.
Oh, okay.
And then that's how my dad was able to get all his qualifications mm-hmm. to become a powerhouse operator.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that's great.
So, he knew the work, but he just wasn't good at writing.
Yeah. So what does Anzac Day mean to you and your family?
Well, Anzac Day has always been special in the family. And, you know, when I was little, you know, we used to, in those times, we used to have, you know, Red Cross and stuff like this. And we used to go to the dawn service.
This is in Rolls.
And I remember doing that when I was little, going to dawn services. And then as my dad, he didn't like to really participate. You know, it was more, as I was saying before, staying home.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go and watch the march with him when it was televised on TV. Like we would watch the march together, and I always made sure that Anzac Day I always spent with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he just, you know, it's about remembering Uncle George as well.
Yeah.
Since I've lost my dad, and they started the Black Diggers March,
mm-hmm.
I go to that,
mm-hmm.
and the last few years we've made up big banners and wear them around us
mm-hmm.
to make sure that they're not forgotten.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, in the general march on Anzac Day, you're not allowed to have banners or anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's a way of saying, well, you know, these are Aboriginal soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've had some, you know, is it Too Dark for the Light Horse?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. And my dad's photos and everything were all in that. That was after he passed away. And his medals and that were loaned for that museum. What was it? Mm-hmm. Museum. It's a shame that that's not a permanent feature.
Mm.
I think that needs to be a permanent exhibition.
Yeah.
It's sort of been, you know, they had it and then it's sort of packed away. Finished, and then they bring it out and things like this. And I think that really does need, like, it's great to have a memorial, but I think there needs to be a permanent exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be, you know, where the Aboriginal soldiers were coming from,
mm-hmm.
you know, the conditions that they actually were living in and where they actually came from when they went over, because I think it's a significant part in history where white and black came together mm-hmm. to fight a war to defend this land, and this land was taken from our people. Yet they mm-hmm. came together to actually defend it when they thought that this land was going to be lost to another group of people.
So it's an important part of Australian
history. Well, I think it's an important part of history, and I don't think that way of thinking is actually even, people are not even talking about that.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, the importance of that. You know, these were men who had no, you know, were no say. They didn't even have a vote. They had limited money. They were discriminated. They weren't allowed to go into bars. They weren't allowed, you know, to integrate a lot. They had all these different, you know, policies on them. You know, at that time, what are you looking at? You know, there was segregation.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Policies around that, government policies at that time. Yet they came together, and there's quite a number of them that actually came and went into the army and fought for this land. And I think that's, you know, that's quite a significant event in, you know, white and black relations in Australia. And that fight, you know, I think is still... they should acknowledge that.
Well, they're currently developing a public memorial to honour Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander servicemen and women, which will be going installed in Hyde Park in Sydney. So, yeah, that will be an important part of recognising their stories as well.
Well, I think that's it. I think that's important, but I think it, you know, I think Sydney lacks. Well, I was talking to my daughter, and she was saying, "Mum, you know, you can walk into Sydney and you can go to the museum and you can see the Holocaust and what happened to the Jews in the Second World War, and there's a museum to show that. Where's the museum that shows what's happened to Aboriginal people?" And when you talk about war, which, you know, it's like, well, what about our warriors who fought? You know, there was a 100-year war fought in Australia, you know, before Australia, it was pacified, you know. And this war where, you know, the two biggest tribes, you know, when they came over the mountains, you know, Wiradjuri and Gamilaroi came together to actually fight off the white fellas. Yeah, so, you know, when you talk about Aboriginal men in war, they usually talk about Aboriginal men who went to war in the First World War and the Second World War and the continuance, but they don't look at Aboriginal men who were at war in the resistance. And I think there should be a museum that actually recognises that. And when they're looking at that memorial, it's not only to be an ANZAC memorial, but it should be a memorial recognising there has been, you know, a lot of our ancestors died in the resistance, in the resistance war against the resettlement of this country, which that battle is just totally ignored. Many battles are totally ignored.
Yeah, it's not a story that's widely told.
No. And, you know, it's sad that you can actually walk, you know, go into Sydney and you can go into the museum and see, you know, the Holocaust and what happened to everybody and blah, 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 which is very sad. But you never see what's happened to Aboriginal people. And this is our, you know, this is our country too. And so I'd like to see something like that. I'd like to see something more permanent for Aboriginal Australia on the whole. That shows what's happened from the beginning and the truth. You know, not about, let's be realistic, let's talk about the genocide and the policy of genocide and the events that happened. They're not very nice, but they're all being documented and they should be there. They should be part of it.
That's very true. I think we've
The importance of continuing.
Yeah, I think we've covered all those. So I guess, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
I really think it's important that white Australia knows the history because it hasn't been told, and the history, even when you go to school, you know, snippets have been told. I noticed that on one of the workbooks that's been put out by the War Memorial, I think it's their education, one of their education ones, there's actually pictures of my father on one of those workbooks. None of the family have been contacted.
Haven't they?
No. Mm-hmm. So we don't, you know... And that's really, and sometimes the right information as well, because I know that a lot of the photos of my dad that were on the website didn't have the correct information on them. and the correct dates and that type of thing. And one of them was, which was maybe a little thing for somebody else, but it was very distressing because it was talking about, you know, my Uncle George had died in the prison camp and my father was released 6 months later.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which is totally incorrect. He wasn't released 6 months later. So making sure that the information that is right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
so a lot of the information needs to be verified with family.
And needs to be checked and within their own systems as well. Mm-hmm. Because I know with the War Memorial one, the information was there and it was, you know, it's just somebody just didn't do their research. It's all there about when the war ended in 1945. Well, why would my father be released in 1943?
Yeah.
So I think that that should happen. Mm. I think that it's great that we do have a separate service to remember the soldiers. What I'm trying to do this year is get more family members to actually be involved, and especially the younger ones. Like my children, I've taken along to the Black Diggers March, so I'm hoping that they will continue that with their children.
Yeah,
and that they won't be forgotten with what's happened to them, because they were a minority as well. Like, you know, there's very few of them. I don't know, like in the prison camp, I don't even know. I think there was over in Japan, in Nyatsu, I think there was one more Aboriginal prisoner, prison camp, soldier in the prison camp with my dad.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there was a number that were in Changi that were taken. And, getting the recognition that they should have got. It's no use coming after they're passed away.
Yeah.
And it being continued. And I think, there's been sort of a history in the Beale family of Aboriginal men going to war, so that's actually continued through other wars. Yeah. Where, sons, all sort of followed that military line as well.
Excellent. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, so I've got to check on all this. Yeah.